And I don't really know anything about this subject, but I stayed at a Holiday Inn Express last night, so I'm going to just try to, get through it. Now, actually, I've been in national security and intelligence for most of my career. I spent over 20 years in Washington working for Congress and snooping around the intelligence agencies in the Pentagon. And 9/11, well, just a few hours before the corridor of the Pentagon was hit by the plane, I went that walk down that corridor. So it was very, I think everybody in Washington has their 9/11 stories, but that was a little too close for comfort for me. So I'm very well aware of the terrorism. Terrorism is one of my big issues, but I have a starkly different opinion from most people. I'm on a terrorism panel later, so I'll only touch on that here. My purpose here is mainly to talk about empire. And I have a new book coming out. It's going to come out in September called The Emperor Has No Clothes. This is The Empire Has No Clothes, U.S. Foreign Policy Exposed. This is the cover. Of course, the book isn't, I don't have the book out yet, but I have another book downstairs at the Independent Institute's table called Putting Defense Back into U.S. Defense Policy. And so my basic orientation here is that the U.S. government has never really done that great a job defending the country. It's defended a lot of other places, and it's still doing that. There was some cause for that during the Cold War when we had a more potent opponent, the Soviet Union. But even during the Cold War, this, as my research for the book that shows, that the leaders actually even admitted hyping the threat. And there are many things that happened during the Cold War which lead you to believe that there were other intentions besides merely fighting the Soviet Union. Now, the neocons have done us a big favor by broaching the subject of the U.S. empire, because we as Americans have this traditional vein in our thought that we're anti-imperialists because we don't like empires, because we broke away from the British Empire. And this vein of thought has come all the way down. And that helped us to stay away from empire for many years, I think. But we first got our first imperial foray was the Spanish-American War. And ostensibly, we were trying to help Cuban revolutionaries against the oppression of the Spanish government. Of course, by the end of the war, we were fighting our own insurgency in the Philippines, and by some historians' account, we killed 200,000 people in a very brutal campaign. And our history books really don't mention this very often. And we killed many more people than we helped in Cuba. So these types of imperial forays often go in one direction or the other. And we've seen this during the Clinton years with Somalia. We saw it during the Reagan years in Lebanon. And you can even argue Kosovo and Bosnia are probably powder kegs waiting to re-erupt if our troops ever leave there. And of course, we have the imperial adventure in Iraq right now. Now, the U.S. does not have an empire in the classic sense. Most people, Americans and otherwise, think of the Roman Empire or the British Empire. These were formal empires that governed people with a colonial governor, viceroy, or whatever. I look back in history, our empire is more informal. It's like the Spartan Empire of ancient Greece. We have alliances, and ostensibly the countries have complete freedom. Of course, our allies do not have complete freedom in the security realm, because we provide their security, and therefore we dictate what they do. They have a little bit more, in some cases a lot of freedom in the domestic realm, but ultimately, are we going to let Germany, Japan, the UK, Italy, France, these big allies, would we let them go back to an authoritarian government? I'm not so sure that we would do that. And in fact, we don't even like developing countries to go back that way. Now, our first global, what I call the American global empire, happened after World War II. Now, some people think this was accidental. I don't think it was. I think we we made decisions in Europe. Eisenhower originally said if U.S. forces are in Europe for a long period of time, NATO has failed. Well, by his definition, NATO has failed because we have troops there 50 years after the war, or actually 60 years now. So we have this global system of alliances. Now, if we all think that this was developed solely because of the Soviet Union, but I say that one significant fact undermines that, and that is the Soviet Union went away, and what do? We did not go to back to our traditional foreign policy, which we had for most of the country, which now seems like an aberration. In fact, there are very few people who remember it, and that was a balancer of last resort. We only got involved if the balance of power got out of whack. Of course, we've expanded our empire after the Cold War. Clinton expanded NATO. He tightened the East Asian alliances. He went into Bosnia, Kosovo, in NATO's name, principally to give the alliance something to do. Of course, we always have, in the United States, Americans are very idealistic. You go to Europe, you find a much different, much more realistic populace over there. But in America, we're idealistic, and therefore, I think to some extent, we are prone to manipulation by our leaders, whether they're Democratic or whether they're Republican. And I think we've seen it in both cases, with Clinton and both Bushes. I'm going to be principally talking mainly post-Cold War foreign policy, but if you want to ask questions on the previous pre-post-Cold War, that is during the Cold War, I'll be happy to talk about that too. But I'd like to talk about why I think that U.S. foreign policy is more consistent. We have a lot of people criticizing George Bush for his intervention in Iraq, invasion, occupation. But of course, and we talk about preemptive war, but we've had preemptive war for a long time. His father invaded Panama with really very little rationale for national security reasons. This guy's a drug-running thug, remember Noriega, who used to be on the CIA payroll. Well, then we get to Clinton, of course, you know, he went into all these various places, and Clinton had more military interventions than any president in recent memory. They were mainly small brush fire things, and after Somalia, he learned his lesson and didn't put U.S. troops on the ground. Well, of course, we have to keep relearning these lessons, and unfortunately, George Bush, I think, has, didn't pay much heed to that. So the difference between Clinton and Bush, too, is one of degree rather than kind. Clinton threatened preemptive war. It's the president is not being very honest there. He's actually waging preventative war. Preemptive war is when if you see the enemy is about ready to attack you, as the Israelis did in 67, you attack them first. I don't think too many people can argue with preemptive war. If you're about ready to be attacked, there's no reason to sit around and wait for the other guy to do that, because you get a tremendous advantage if you strike first. However, this was a preventative war, and most of the other ones, to some extent, which I'll talk about in Clinton's time, were to some extent preventative as well. Preventative war, as opposed to preemptive war, is a very dangerous doctrine, because you can dream up anything you want. This is preventing a future threat. Now, I'll give you an example. Clinton went into, or threatened North Korea with war in 1994 if they didn't halt their nuclear program. That's a preventative war. North Korea did not have a missile, and still does not have a missile, probably, that can launch a heavy nuclear payload to the United States. Now, it may have a missile that can reach us, but a nuclear payload is bigger. So, and back in 1994, they didn't have anything close to that. So this was a sort of a preventative threat. Now, he also used the preemptive label to retaliate. Remember the two embassy bombings in Africa. Clinton used this. First, he was retaliating, but he was also preempting future attacks, he said. Well, it was very suspicious. This happened around the Lewinsky indictment or whatever. And it was also very suspicious because most of the terrorists that would be launching attacks, further attacks, after that would have already been in place to do so. And he hit training camps in this chemical factory, which was never really proven to be making chemical weapons anyway. But so his preemptive rationale was quite suspect. But nonetheless, preemption and preventative war have been used by the United States way before George Bush. George Bush's name, the reason George Bush has taken so much heat over his intervention in Iraq is because he dropped the Wilsonian rhetoric, which his father used and which Clinton used very effectively. That is, we go to the UN and get some sort of a stamp of approval. Or now in the case of Kosovo, the same thing happened to Bush. The UN refused to approve the intervention. So what did Clinton do? He made it a NATO thing. You saw all the briefings. They had the little NATO star on there. And this somehow these international organizations give the United States legitimacy to do these things, and people don't squawk. Well, George Bush dropped a lot of that rhetoric. He's now picked up some of it because he's in trouble, and the link with Al-Qaeda didn't pan out, the weapons of mass destruction didn't pan out, so now he's down to liberating Iraq. And of course, now with the prisoner scandal and censoring the newspapers and giving non-free market contractors to cronies and delaying the real elections there, which is what's going to happen, he doesn't have much rationale left. So you see all these, and of course we don't want to really believe that democratization nonsense, and we didn't want to believe it from Clinton, and we shouldn't believe it from Bush either, because that's not the real purpose of these interventions. As I remember, as I said before, the leaders oftentimes come up with these rationale that they think the people will consume, where there are very real realpolitik reasons for doing Iraq. Now, I don't want to dwell on Iraq because I think we'll probably get into that in another session later, entitled something like "Should We, Convert Them at the Point of a Gun?" or something. I can't remember what the title of the session is, but it's basically, should we take our democratic show on the road, by force? Now, my book is going to be addressed to everyone. I have one chapter for conservatives, one chapter for liberals, and one chapter for everyone else. But I think both the liberal and the conservative chapters might be appropriate here, because I'll start with the conservatives first. Now, we have this empire which has actually grown after the Cold War ended, which is striking because the Cold War enemy was much more potent than Al-Qaeda would ever be. And yet we see the empire, which is less useful for fighting terrorism, grow bigger. And in fact, I think the empire makes terrorism more likely. So in fact, what we're doing is we're defending, we're pushing our defense perimeter out at the same time that the terrorists are infiltrating all layers of the defense perimeter and hitting the core. I mean, the September 11th attacks were unique because very rarely in our history has the homeland been attacked. 1812 and Pearl Harbor, the fringes of the homeland were attacked. Hawaii wasn't a state then, but nonetheless, major outposts. But it hasn't happened very often, and that's why it is a big deal. But I say that there's two different things. The neocons and some other conservatives will tell you that you have to defeat this far forward to keep it away from our shores. Now, this is the rationale that Bush developed after nothing else worked. We're going to fight terrorism in Iraq rather than at home. Well, that assumes that the number of terrorists that you have is constant, which, of course, this probably, and now with the prisoner scandal, we can't underestimate the effect of this on the recruiting of new terrorists. So I think empire works to the opposite of national security. And I think we should pay more attention focused on defending our shores and less so on this expanding empire. Now, I mentioned the NATO expansion. The war on terrorism has been used, and administration officials have admitted doing this to create bases in Central Asia and the former Soviet Union. They went into Georgia, Yemen, the Philippines. They're dying to get back into the Philippines because we got thrown out of our base in Subic Bay there. It was a huge naval base. They're putting more naval forces in Guam, principally directed at China. And so we have this empire, but the problem that we have is that it leads to blowback terrorism. And I'll be discussing that later. I don't want to deal with that as much now either. But I think I'm going to start with the conservatives. Why conservatives should be against empire? Because I think at this point in time, the conservatives are slightly, now of course I'm making generalizations here, the conservatives are slightly more for empire than the liberals, although the liberal interventionists are for a certain type of empire, which doesn't differ that much from what the neoconservatives. But there's more opposition to empire now on the left, slightly, but only slightly. And then, of course, you have factions of either camp. You have the liberal interventionists, you have the liberals who are not too enthusiastic about this. On the conservatives, you have the neoconservatives, and then you have some other conservatives who are a distinct minority who are less enthusiastic about this. But I'm going to first make the arguments why conservatives should be against empire. First of all, this costs a lot of money. We've already spent $200 billion in Iraq because it's going to, if it turns out to be $50 billion this year, which the administration is now admitting to, we pour $200 billion into this country. Of course, this defense spending also erodes our growth rates, our economic growth rates. Government spending is just like any other government spending. There's an opportunity cost in research and development and everything that the private sector could be doing with that money. Now, people say, well, but we need this to safeguard our security. Well, most of the defense budget is not spent fighting terrorism. And it's, to anyone who knows anything about the defense budget, this argument that we have to increase defense spending after 9/11, it's really ludicrous because you really fight terrorists mostly with intelligence and law enforcement. Now, you need the occasional military strike in Afghanistan, perhaps, but even if you think that that's necessary, it doesn't cost very much to fight small wars in Afghanistan and these failed states. We used B-52s, which are very old, and we used special forces on horseback. And of course, it wasn't much of a fight at all. So we may need some military force, but much of this is spent on its public choice economics in both intelligence and defense. Happening here. You find that we're still building weapons from the Cold War. We have an F-22 fighter, the most high-tech fighter in the world, except that there's nobody to fight. The aircraft it was designed to go against were trashed when the Soviet Union went down. We're building submarines, new submarines, when our submarines are already vastly superior to any other on the planet. And of course, the only other ones on the planet are rusting up in Murmansk. Because the Russian Navy doesn't get out much anymore. So these types of weapons are being built because they have constituencies. And Rumsfeld, to his credit, has killed a couple of army systems, the Comanche helicopter and the Crusader artillery piece. But it's like pulling teeth to do these things. And I think he has had some good intentions in that area, but we see the public choice theory working here. Intelligence is the same way. We keep lamenting the fact that we don't have enough covert agents, but we have satellites, we have other means of collection. And why do we have these? And that was fine during the Cold War when you have the Soviet tank army sitting at the Fulda Gap in Germany. You look down on them, if they start moving the bridging equipment to the river, they're going to invade. So you need these overhead systems. Well, overhead systems don't tell you much about small terrorist groups who are very zealous and they're very secretive. So what you need is agents to penetrate. We have a very poor capability on that, and we rely heavily on foreign intelligence agencies to provide that. But the reason that we do, they keep lamenting this fact, they're going to keep lamenting it because the amount of covert agents, that was just in the paper the other day, we have less than 1,100 worldwide. Well, the reason is because most of the money in the intelligence budget goes to these big systems who have constituencies and factories in certain congressional districts. So we keep saying, well, geez, we have to reorient this. We have to reorient the Defense Department. And Rumsfeld has been trying to do that, but these these big defense contracts and intelligence contracts go to the people who are still building Cold War era systems. So we see that this costs a lot of money. It erodes our growth rates, and I think we may be making the mistake that the British and the French did prior to World War II. They were so concerned with the overseas empire that they forgot about the looming threat of Nazi Germany. Now, we have the same situation here with China. Now, I'm not saying China is going to become a threat. I think it's too early to tell. We may get democracy there eventually. It may turn out to be a benign power. So we can't make any assumptions. It's much too early. But China is not going to be a threat militarily for 20 to 30, probably 40 years. The military is still, you never know this by reading it in the press, but the military is just modernized a bit here and a bit there with Russian systems. And the reason they can't, the reason they're buying Russian systems is because their defense industry has been grossly incompetent in producing weapon systems. So, but this they have the growth rates. If it continues to grow, that they could eventually become a problem. So, but what are we doing? We have this extended empire. We're building all these weapon systems that will be out of date by the time China becomes a problem. And what we're liable to do is restrict our growth rates in the competition by excessive defense spending, et cetera, that we may lose out to their, because they learned their lesson from the Soviet Union. Their defense spending is the fourth among their priorities, which is the lowest, and they are putting all their resources into economic development and that sort of thing. Now, of course, their growth rates may not continue at that pace, because growth rates usually trail off as economies become more developed. They could have a stagnation like Japan, where they have economic reforms, but their communist legacy prevents them from, you know, going all the way, and they create a situation like Japan has, where they have still too much government intervention, and their growth rates are stagnant. So we don't know if they're going to become a power, but the prudent thing to do is look after your long-term security rather than your short-term security. And we really don't have any great power threats right now. As much as you see about China in the papers, or you did until 9/11, because the defense establishment needs an enemy to fight, frankly. And I've seen this happen before in meetings at the Pentagon and everything else. They figure out, now the war on terrorism is helping to justify all this spending. Of course, the voters don't know that the spending really doesn't go to fight terrorism. Very little of it does. But nonetheless, what we should probably do, if we're worried about China in the future, is scale back our defense spending. Now we can always build it up. And as I mentioned, these weapon systems are going to be largely out of date by the time that China would rise in 20 to 40 years anyway. The generation of weapon systems is usually about 20 years. Another reason, in addition to the reduced growth, economic growth, that excessive defense spending puts forth, it affects negatively economic growth. The second thing is, if our growth rates are restricted by a point or two over time, we could have the same, we could end up in the same place as the British did. 1913, if you would ask any Briton, well, you think in 30 years your empire is going to be flat on its back? Because it was the height of the British Empire in 1913. They got involved in two big world wars, and of course their empire dissolved. And so will we be a great power? You can't become overextended. Right now, we account for 40% of the world's defense spending and about 30% of the world's GDP. And that's overextension. We have had so many defense commitments around the world. There's so many formal alliances. Then we have informal alliances with Taiwan, Israel, et cetera. And if called upon to fulfill these, we could easily become overextended very rapidly, and not just overextended on paper, but overextended by actual expenditures. And we see this because Iraq is, frankly, a very poor nation, developing nation. We have an insurgency which right now doesn't encompass the entire Iraqi population, and it's giving the best military in the world, the most powerful military ever assembled on the planet, problems, and guerrilla war does that. And I suspect the neocons went into Iraq for a demonstration effect. This is going to show Syria and Iran and all these other countries we really mean business. Well, what it's actually showed them is how to defeat the United States, just like the Vietnamese did in a guerrilla warfare. And so I think it's had the opposite effect there. So the other thing is, if you're so overextended, you may actually lose your great power status eventually. So you have to, the great empires of the world, like Britain, they managed, they played off the continental powers, they stayed out of major wars until, of course, World War I and World War II, and that capsized the whole ship there. So I think conservatives have to be careful, even if you're a national greatness conservative, you had better be careful that we may not have national greatness after being overextended. Now, what other things should conservatives be worried about? Well, if any of you have read Crisis and Leviathan by Bob Higgs of the institute that I work in, it's an excellent book because it shows that wars and crises lead to big government. And if you're a libertarian, wars are the biggest cause of big government. And therefore, many libertarians are a little iffy on the defense issue, but and David Bose's speech just before this indicates that in wartime, we see a drastic increase in domestic spending, which has nothing to do with the war. As he mentioned, Bush has increased domestic discretionary spending at a rate not heard of since LBJ. And of course, LBJ was a wartime president. And LBJ and Bush have done the exact same thing. Different party, same policy, guns and butter. And of course, the butter that we're talking about is not private sector butter, but government-issued butter. So I think it's very difficult. Certainly, we need national security spending, but the problem is we can't see, we can't be like Don Quixote and see all these threats, which don't really, which aren't really threats, actually. We have very good security here intrinsically. We have huge oceans and weak neighbors, weak and friendly neighbors. And the founders knew this, and they like to stay out of people's business. And that's the foreign policy we ran up until World War I, basically. And during that time, our country grew into the colossus it is now. Because we've had very few wars here in North America, and that's why we have had a lot of prosperity. And when we get into foreign wars, as I mentioned, we lose our government gets bigger. But we also, and I'm into the liberal chapter, but I think libertarians would certainly be interested in this. Of course, and we see this in the current war on terror, we lose civil liberties. Before every major war or during every major war, we've had erosions of civil liberties. In World War I, we had people arrested for dissenting against the war. Of course, in World War II, we had even worse with the Japanese internment camps, etc. Now we see the Patriot Act. During Vietnam, we saw the FBI and the Army spying and the CIA spying on domestic groups, etc. So I think we need to be very careful. Government increases not only as a government spending, but also powers and authority of government. So in this case, big government is both a liberal and a conservative concern and a libertarian concern, I think. We have these erosions of civil liberties, and it used to be that imperial wars were considered less of a problem. If you have a major threat to the homeland, like World War II, people are feeling more fear, so they say, oh yes, well, we have to return the Japanese Americans because they could be a threat to us. But imperial wars were always perceived as, well, that's a far-flung brushfire war. It really doesn't threaten us that much during the Cold War, as an example. But now I think that's changed. We have terrorists that are trying to hit our homeland and kill many people. And of course, we've had more fear in this country than we probably had during World War II. I mean, the only thing that the Japanese, I think, fired a submarine off Los Angeles, and they tried to send over some balloons in a botched biological warfare attempt. But I think that's other than attacking Pearl Harbor, I think that's all of, that they ever did to our homeland. Here we have a threat to, you know, major cities, sporting events, our transportation systems, etc. So people are very scared. So I think you see these erosions of civil liberties happening even with brush fire wars now, when the threat is not that great. Now, we really have to ask ourselves, let's say that this idea that we're going to have this empire, this benevolent empire, let's say that we actually mean it, which I don't really think we do, given the U.S. history. I mean, we've overthrown democratic regimes, and I mean, this is just a few of them. Guatemala, Chile, Iran, and I'll stop there because there's plenty more, but and also in Europe after World War II, we made sure that the democratic elections that we had were rigged in our favor, or at least parties friendly to the U.S. So we haven't had a very good track record in supporting democracy, but let's assume, just for the sake of argument, that that our government really is genuinely cares about Iraqis and wants to democratize them, which I doubt. But let's just assume that. Will it be successful? Well, we haven't had a very good success rate in doing this, at least in recent history. The Somalia thing went south. Bosnia and Kosovo are still, they're sitting, our troops are sitting in Bosnia, been sitting there for 9 years. Clinton, remember, he told us it was only going to be a year. But here we are 9 years later, and if they take the troops out, they're going to start fighting again. Same with Kosovo. Haiti, well, of course, our repeated attempts at intervening in Haiti over the last century have created, helped create, I should say, a basket case. So we haven't been very successful at this. And Max Boot, who's some of you may know him, he used to work for the Wall Street Journal. I think he's now at the Council on Foreign Relations. He's a big neoconservative. He's for taking democracy to other places around the world at the point of a gun. But even he admits that our record in the developing world has been very spotty. Of course, the neoconservatives always rely on the Japan and Germany example. But of course, it's not a very good example for the developing world. I'll go into that in another presentation. I don't think I will dwell on that here. But we have to realize the fact that even if our government is sincere in bringing democracy to these places, it hasn't been very successful at all. And part of the reason for that is it's very difficult to remake a society. We're talking about the case of Iraq, which just demonstrates what I'm talking about. I mean, we're getting a lot of criticism from the Democrats that they bungled the post-war military planning and occupation planning, didn't have enough troops, etc. And that's probably true, but I say they made their biggest mistake by going in and thinking they could do this in the first place. I mean, this is a country the size of California, has 25 million people in it, and they're trying to subdue the country with less troops than in a couple of sports stadiums. And also, there's only about 20,000 troops out patrolling at a time. We have about 135,000 there, but you have all the logistics, you have the command structure, you have all this overhead. So you only have about 20,000 people out at a time. Of course, if we're going to rely on the Iraqi police, that's a joke. And it's been proven to be a joke because every time there's a big firefight, they run away. So, and now, of course, they're scared to be associated with the Americans. So you have all these problems, but you're trying to remake a society into a Western-style democracy. They've never had any experience with democracy. And many experts in Iraq said that they were going to have these problems, but they were never listened to, unfortunately. But this doesn't just apply to Iraq. I mean, we've seen this time and again. When you have fractious societies like Somalia, where you have different groups running around, you're not going to be able to go in there and remake the society. You can go in and separate the forces, as they've done in Bosnia and Kosovo. But then what they try to do is they try to bring in a bunch of governments, top-down driven development programs, which haven't really worked in non-war situations, and they're surprised when this government planning doesn't work. I'm always struck by people who are for, who are against the government action at home, but they're for, they think the U.S. government can remake other societies, and the government, the U.S. government has less legitimacy in those societies than it does here. So I don't understand how that, all this optimism, and we keep failing all the time, but we don't learn the lessons from this, we just keep doing it. And frankly, Iraq is just like Somalia, is just like the other attempts at this in the past. But of course, you get the old economist defense, well, you just didn't do it right. You know, if you had done what I said the correct way, it would work. Well, you have to start asking ourselves, can we really do this? I think people have to accept democracy over time. And the model probably should be more like Eastern Europe, or the former Soviet, or the Soviet Union, where the system fell apart and the people were forced to adopt. And who did they turn to? Well, they turned to at least to try a model like this. But as we see in Russia, Russia seems to be backsliding. It's not a guarantee. But the other thing I think that we need to remember here is that war works our own society. It leads to an imperial presidency, which we have already, but it makes it worse. It leads to the emasculation of the Congress. As I mentioned, it becomes us versus them. It erodes civil liberties. There are many things that happen. It perverts our own system. So even if we're successful in bringing democracy to other lands, we may be eroding democracy here at home. And I think that's a big factor that many people who advocate these things don't understand, because it's not an obvious effect. But an empire, this has happened in previous empires. The Roman Empire, as it became expanded and took over more land, it went from a republic into an empire. And gradually we saw the power shift from the Senate to the emperor. And this has happened repeatedly over time in history. And if you don't think it can happen here, certainly we have a much freer country than most places, but the Roman Republic was fairly free as well. So this thing can happen anywhere. And I think the internal effects of empire far outweigh the external effects. If they're not bad enough, getting people killed, spending a lot of money, and getting blowback terrorism, if you don't think that's bad, then I think the domestic effects of this are probably worse. And now let's look at this. I'll give an example. The Congressional War Power. The Constitution is very, you know, the constitutional debates are vague on certain issues, but they weren't on the war power, because the founders looked out at the European monarchs who regularly took their countries to war, and the cost of war, both the losing their lives and taxes, heavy taxation, fell on who? The common person. Meanwhile, the ruler was out there gallivanting all over, invading countries, etc. Well, the founders didn't really like that, and so they made the war power. They put it in the legislature, which is supposed to be representative of the people. Well, we declared for major conflagrations or conflicts, we declared war up until the Cold War started. Well, what was different about the Cold War? That's when the empire started. That's when we had a permanent war footing, even when we were at peace. And it's similar to the war on terrorism. I mean, we're not fighting the war on terrorism every day, but it's still hanging over us. And what happened was, Truman, when he decided to take action in Korea for the first time, did not get a declaration of war from Congress. And now we see people who don't examine the history of the debates in the Constitutional Convention, we see them saying, well, the president can take us to war. Both Democrats and Republicans say this. Now, there are some from each party that say, wait a minute, aren't we supposed to be declaring war? But of course, we don't even want to use the term war anymore. Remember, Korea and Vietnam were police actions. War is a bad term, so we don't want to declare it, because then all sorts of things, legal things happen. But we also don't want to declare it because we live in a society of euphemism, and, well, you know, war is out as a term. But the Congress is supposed to declare war, and the president is not just supposed to take us to war. But unfortunately, the empire has led to the fact that the president has taken over many powers. And when as a result, we have things like the Iran-Contra scandal, et cetera, where the president kind of goes beyond his power. In Kosovo, Clinton didn't ask the Congress. So I think both, to sum up, the internal effects, and they're the least well known, I think are worse than the external effects of an empire. But nonetheless, both are bad, and I think we need to really reconsider our extended defense perimeter. Perhaps get out of some of these Cold War alliances. We're defending rich countries who should be defending themselves, and we should stop intervening in places where we really don't need to be.